We have reached a verdict already. We all just kind of looked at each other and nodded. We find the defendant guilty of charges.
Weight 105?
Yeah,
in your bra.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard!
Hey! Quiet!
Whether it's race judicata or stare decisis, there is no basis for imposing some draconian policy with regard to bail, nunc pro tunc.
Your Honor, the defense is now just making up words.
We came into your trial. Oh, look how cute. There's like a judge and everything. And jury people.
Vote for Al!
Ladies.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 203. You know, I kind of bumbled that intro there a little bit in my mouth, but you know what? We don't even have time. We don't have time to redo it. This is an early. we got to get this out as soon as we can. How's it going, Andrew?
Yeah, this is a this, no this time is for a pleasantries. Calculon does one take moment.
Oh, big news day yesterday and continuing into today and whenever you're hearing this, most likely. Ooh, how you feeling?
I have not slept. I have been. You know, you messaged me yesterday and you were like, okay, so Manafort verdict came in and Cohen has pled guilty. Let's record. And I was like, I don't know what to say yet. I've got to read the documents first. But now.
But
I
we just came on here to say nothing to report. See, yeah, okay. Right. On to TTTV.
Everything is yeah. Normal. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
No, this drastically changes the landscape. I am really, really proud. I mean, particularly when we get into the Michael Cohen stuff in the B segment. This is, you know, exactly what we said way back in OA 154, and I'm proud of the work that we've done on the show. And
so is this essentially a massive yodeling episode slash Andrew was right episode, pretty much?
I think so. This is, if we could.
We always knew the two storylines. Right. Yeah. The yodeling storyline and the Andrew was right storyline would come together like the end of Return of the King and everything.
There you go.
It's a good book. Okay, we got stuff to get to. Manafort, yep. Cohen, we got all of it. Let's go. Here we go. So, Manafort, I know, wow. Andrew, in our notes, has a ton of bullet points, which means this could be a 7-hour episode. But no, we're going to have to keep to time. I'm mainly surprised. You know, the jury was taking forever, and then they handed him that note that was like, what is a jury? You know, it was like, no, it was, what is, what are we doing here? The note said what?
I?
It said, define reasonable doubt, which I thought was an interesting OA-related thing, because you've talked about both the jury handing notes and what exactly is reasonable doubt and all that. But I was just amazed. It seemed to me that this should have been a slam dunk, but explain what the verdict actually was. I think it was 8 counts, right? And then not a split decision or whatever on 11 or something.
So the jury returned a verdict of guilty on 8 counts, and they returned a hung jury, which results in a mistrial, which can be... you can get a mistrial on individual counts on 10 others, right? So we're going to go through those. We do not know yet because the juror names have been held confidential. They will be released. The court will unseal those records. The court has also granted the AP, CBS, and media parties rights to intervene in the case and access portions of the trial record. So we're going to learn a lot about this case. But right now, we don't know who the jurors are. And so what we don't know is, was there one person who was a holdout, right? Like federal juries require unanimity. We've talked about how in the state they do not require unanimity, but federal juries require unanimity. So you could have just had one person who was not convinced, and we're going to talk about each of these specific counts in kind of buckets, right?
You know, I don't like counts, those odds. Yeah, like, ahead. If I were the prosecution, and what are the odds that I can ensure that 12 out of 12 people won't be some insane MAGA person that's like not gonna, you know, like, yeah, I don't like those odds.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are a couple of things with respect to that, right? And that was speculating, kind of flying wildly on our Open Arguments Twitter thread, on, you know, in kind of lefty media sources, is could one, you know, MAGA hat wearing person, you know, gum up the works? And look, the answer to that is always yes, right?
Right.
That one person can gum up the works.
What happened was, like, one juror after the verdict, like, took off a really huge wig, and underneath the wig was a MAGA hat that he had on the whole time. They couldn't take off because it's part of them.
But, you know, when I went through this, I came to certain conclusions. I don't think that there is a political element here in the jury's failure to get to unanimity on all the counts. And okay. I'll explain that. So here's what we have. Counts 1 to 5 returned a guilty verdict. Those are the filing of the false tax returns from 2010 to 2015. That covers $14 million in fraudulent income not reported on the taxes. And that
can
is,
I ask a really quick, simple question, yeah, that I just occurred to me? Is there any logic to the ordering of the counts? Like, is there 1 through 5 are going to be like your most solid charges, or is it just random or in statute order or something?
Yeah, it is at the discretion of the prosecutors how they order it. They do not order it in count, right? In terms of, right, 18 U.S.C. 1344 right, goes right, here, right, and then 26 U.S.C. 7206 goes here. Usually you order the counts in the way that you've told the story in the indictment. At least that's what I do when
I just wasn't sure if it was like a coincidence or not that like 1 through 5 were, you know, solid or whatever. But okay.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. And there often is that relationship, right? Like, so when I am drafting a civil complaint, right, if that civil complaint has, you know, a breach of contract claim, and then I have, as an alternative, an unjust enrichment claim, right? So breach of contract says we had this agreement, you broke it, and you owe the money on the contract. And then you would argue in the alternative, unjust enrichment, right? Even if I can't prove that there was a contract for some reason, I still did this thing for you, and therefore you have to recompense me for the service that I've provided, or, you know, whatever, under the contract, even in the absence of the contract. And in that situation, I would list the breach of contract claim first, and so would every attorney I know, right? So there is, you know, you may infer some notion of the strength of the counts from their ordering, but not necessarily. So in any event, first 5 counts, false tax returns. And I want to point out there is an intent element in filing false tax returns, right? Mm. It says that the law requires any person who willfully makes and subscribes any return which contains or is verified by written declaration that is made under the penalties of perjury, right? And you have to sign that when you sign your tax return, and which he does not believe to be true and correct as to every material matter, shall be guilty of a felony. So the jury found, right, and think about that in
yeah, because like I, right, math errors. Me and my CPA did mess up my tax returns this year, but like, right, I don't think I'm going to be on trial for a felony. We just issued a correction.
Right, right. That's exactly right. People make mistakes. People make math errors, characterization errors, you know that. So the jury was convinced that Paul Manafort intended to lie on his tax return.
For example, me and my CPA, we just happened to leave off the $100 million in the Cayman Islands that... it was just a math mistake. I put a zero instead of $100 million. It's a simple math error.
Gene Hackman is heading out there right now to make sure he takes care of the beer leaking under the closet. Anyway, all right. Count 12 is the failure to file the foreign bank account reports. This is in the middle of a series of counts from 11 to 14 that cover 2011 to 2014. Manafort was only convicted for failure to file this FBAR for 2012. The jury was hung unable to reach a verdict on the other accounts. And again, this has an intent requirement to it. And the way in which I interpret this result is actually has to do with and Andrew was wrong. I said at the outset of the trial, right, that, you know, Judge Ellis was, kind of old and cranky and cheeky, and I liked him. And, you know, I don't think we need to get into it here, but certainly his conduct in the trial was prejudicial to the prosecutors, right? He made it very, very difficult for the prosecution team to introduce the appropriate chain of documents that was needed to document some of these failure to file FBAR reports. And I think that what happened here is that the jury took that really, really seriously, right? Sat down and said, okay, can we match up the chain on all that? No, we don't, you know, we don't necessarily have a full story. We think it's probably true, but, you know, at least one person said, I don't know that I can connect up all of these dots necessary for this, technical failure. And again, you know, there's an intent requirement. It requires that you willfully violate a regulation or willfully fail to file the report, right? So that's how I interpret the failure to reach a verdict on those other counts. And then we get to the really, really interesting sections, which are counts 24 to 32. And these include various bank loans that were made to Paul Manafort, and for which there is both a count of bank fraud and a count of bank fraud conspiracy. And in each of these cases, what the jury did was reached a verdict of guilty on two separate bank loans, right? A $3.5 million loan to lender B, we don't know who that is, $1 million loan to lender C, but did not reach a verdict as to the conspiracy element. And the way in which I would interpret that is the conspiracy element says that Manafort and Gates came up with a conspiracy to defraud the banks. And if you think that they weren't in agreement, right, then you would say, okay, there's no conspiracy, right? Nevertheless,
I thought,
right,
didn't
there
Gates
is,
say, yep, this is what we did?
Yes, Gates did say this is what we did, right? But remember that, you know, he was subjected to cross-examination, and that's the way in which I interpret that. Right? I said at the time, I didn't think it was a particularly effective cross-examination, right? That was the, did you disclose your fourth, you know, mistress, and, you know, when you're stealing money from Manafort to support all your mistresses,
right.
I think at least one juror said, I don't know that I believe Gates's testimony. And that has serious Yodely implications, right? Because Rick Gates was the star witness in this trial and will be the star witness in the next trial. Manafort is facing charges in the District of Columbia, which we'll talk about in a minute, and seems to be a very central figure in the Mueller investigation. And so, you know, if you're looking for red flags, that's one red flag. I'm about to tell you the biggest red flag.
Ooh.
And those are counts 29 to 32, in which the jury failed to reach agreement as to all of those counts. And those are the counts related to the total $16 million loan from the Federal Savings Bank in Chicago that was directed by Stephen Kalk. We talked about him once the exhibit list came out. This was the Chicago banker that Manafort promised he would get made Secretary of the Army in exchange for Kalk basically looting out most of the small Federal Savings Bank's reserves and loaning $16 million to Manafort in a way that the other bank operators testified. Look, this is, I mean, this put, you know, the bank's assets at risk. It was totally improper, and it was a very, very clear allegation of a quid pro quo. We have documents that were introduced at the trial that 2 weeks after the election, Manafort sent an email to Rick Gates that said, we need to discuss Steve Kalk for Secretary of the Army. And then There's a subsequent email in December, a couple weeks later, in which Manafort wrote another email that was marked urgent, and it was a list of people who needed to be invited to the inauguration, and it included Stephen Koch's name on it. The jury did not return a verdict on those counts regarding the clearest connection between Donald Trump and Paul Manafort. Right. As we've talked about, all of the rest of this is, you know, evidence that Manafort was a bad guy up until the time in which he took over the reins of the Trump campaign. Right. He was working for a Russian stooge who got elected the president of Ukraine. He was hiding ass out, right? All that. But none of that washes over onto Donald Trump. This does. And the jury did not return a verdict on those counts. So. Big red flag. I want to point out that that is not the end of it, right? Reaching a mistrial on these counts means that the government can absolutely bring those charges again.
Okay, yeah, that was going to be my question. So yeah, for all of the mistrial ones, was he found not guilty on anything, or was it just guilty and mistrial?
It was just guilty and mistrial, failure to reach agreement.
So there was no Vin Diesel situation.
there was no Vin Diesel situation. And you know, and a weird thing happened here, right? Which is that usually, if you have a hopelessly deadlocked jury, before you declare a hung jury and a mistrial, then we've talked about this in prior episodes. The judge, either sua sponte on his own, or the lawyers will request that an Allen charge be read. And we've actually read the substance of that on the air, so I won't do it again here. But basically it says, you know, the judge will send back an instruction that encourages...
I thought that happened.
I didn't think an Allen charge got read. If it did... Then,
oh,
then
I thought I saw... You know, there's a lot of news, so who knows?
Yeah.
That could be
wrong. Then let's...
But
so
I
scratch,
did see... Yeah. I thought I saw the judge saying, hey, please go deliberate more, and it didn't take, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I saw that. We'll leave this segment in.
I
saw an encouragement by the judge to go back and continue to deliberate. I did not see a formal Allen charge. If one was issued, then I didn't see it. An Allen charge is very, very strong language, right? It tells people to reconsider on the jury rather than, you know, just keep deliberating. And, you know, despite the fact that we thought, you know, you might have the Vin Diesel, they're out 14 hours and they come back on Friday and we had to wait until Tuesday. That's still not a lot of time for a complex case for a jury to stay out. So, you know, if this were the difference between somebody walking and not, I think there would have been an Allen charge. I think they would have the jury would have been. I'm stunned the jury wasn't sequestered to begin with. I think the jury would have been encouraged to continue to deliberate and reach a result before reporting that they were hopelessly deadlocked. As we go through what happens. Ultimately, from this defendant's perspective, reaching a verdict on those charges, on the Stephen Koch lender charges, would not have substantially altered the result from Manafort's perspective, right? He's going to jail. It wouldn't have greatly increased the amount of time that he was going to spend in jail for reasons that I'm about to explain. So, you know, you can see the judge and the lawyers kind of saying, you know, all right, fine. If they, you know, they're deadlocked. We'll reserve the right to retry him. He's got another trial in a month anyway. And, you know, let's just get out of here. You know, we all want to get home to our hot plates. So, I will tell you, even in addition to retrying, right? So you can, the fact that there was a mistrial declared on those 10 counts means that no double jeopardy attaches. The government can get a new indictment and can reach, actually can, on the existing indictment, they don't need to get another one, can recharge Manafort and retry him in the same jurisdiction before another judge in another proceeding. And they may well do that. And in addition, if the Democrats take back the House of Representatives in the midterm elections, the House of Representatives can investigate this matter. There are already documents introduced by Elijah Cummings.
What a novel idea that the that Congress might perhaps take some role in overseeing an oversight and, you know, investigating into massive corruption right very close to the president of the United States. That's a weird thing. Why would they do that?
Yeah. And so they can. Elijah Cummings has already introduced testimony in the record. It is pending in the Congressional Oversight Committee, but it won't be pending if Democrats retake the House. So that's what you need to know from the verdict. And Paul Manafort is going back to prison, and we will talk about for how long and under what conditions. But there you go. There's the breakdown of your Manafort verdict.
All right. Couple quick interjections. One, yep. I want to say, obviously, this is all very, very fresh news. So there is, as it should be clear, there's some things that maybe, you know, we don't necessarily know 100%. Second one is, if you happen to be a new listener to the show, I just want to throw out there all this weird, these weird references and stuff that we're making. There is an opening arguments wiki that will answer all your questions. So before you email or go off confused, that's where you can find out what Yodel Mountain means. But with that said, let's move on. More Manafort, right? What are we we going to talk about? Sentencing? Appeals?
Yeah. Let's start with appeals, right? Because I have gotten a couple of questions that say, essentially, look, Judge Ellis deliberately interjected himself into this trial, right? We talked about him scolding the lawyers and, you know, for rolling their eyes as they were coming back to the bench. And he, in fact, had to give an instruction to the jury that said to the jury, you should not consider, you know, my behavior as the judge as interfering or weighing on how you should reach a verdict. And so the question was, if and when Manafort appeals this verdict, which there's a 30-day motion pending in which they can do some procedural stuff that it's not worth getting into. But at the end of the day, they're going to appeal, directly appeal the verdict. And on appeal, the question is, does Judge Ellis's behavior provide grounds for saying, hey, look, this trial was a circus, right? There was a sideshow going on, and you can't trust anything that's come out of it. So overturn the verdict, send it back, try him again. And the answer to that is, I think almost certainly not, right? I think Judge Ellis's actions are going to be determined on appeal to be what an appellate court will call harmless error. Right. And what the appellate court is going to say is, yeah, Judge Ellis shouldn't have done the things that he did, but the things that he did were overwhelmingly likely to result in the jury being prejudiced against the prosecutors, not against the defendant. And so even if he had not done so, you would have had at least this result, if not worse. So you don't get to come back and ask for a new trial when something bad happened that hurt you at trial. And I thought that was an important, I don't know, got a bunch of questions on it. I think it was a good distinction to make that just because something bad happens at your trial, if it's not prejudicial, if it in fact helped you, you can't use that as the basis for trying to help yourself to get it overturned on appeal. Now, sentencing. The reason why you do not see you when you read the news reports on this and they say, we think Manafort is probably going to spend 5 to 7 years in jail. Here's what they're doing. When you we've talked about this in previous cases, but I think going back to OA 162 was the first time we talked about the federal sentencing guidelines. And the federal sentencing guidelines are a huge manual. I'm going to upload it on the show notes for our listeners who enjoy paging through legal documents. And it essentially is a matrix, right? It says when you are convicted of a federal offense, you figure out the base level of the offense, right? Which literally you just look at a table in this sentencing guideline, and then you add certain factors to it as you're instructed to do so in the manual, and then you get an offense level, and that's a number between 1 and 43. And then you look up on the table.
And part of the matrix is how many ostrich jackets does the person have? Is that one of the modifiers?
Well, shockingly enough, with things like false statements on your tax returns, the magnitude of the harm is in fact part of the adjustment to the offense level. And so what happens here is that when you are convicted of multiple federal crimes, there is a procedure. You don't get, right? Sometimes one of the things you will hear about state crimes is whether sentences run concurrently or consecutively. Right. Which means exactly what it sounds like. Right. If you get 20 years, you know, if you get convicted of 7 murders, 2 run concurrently and they all go up to 30 years, then you're going to serve 30 years. If they run consecutively, then you're going to serve 210 years. And here in federal court, when you are sentencing someone under the federal sentencing guidelines, there is a procedure that says what you do is you take the offense that has the highest baseline offense number, and then you adjust it upwards based on the other offenses for which he was convicted. And here it is the fraudulent bank loans that, by my analysis, carry the highest baseline offense. And that offense, I have calculated the minimum number at a 31, and I'm going to link the chart in which you can just kind of go down. You go down to the row marked 31, and you look over under the column for prior offenses.
It says white collar crime, so don't bother, 0 years.
Yeah. No, this is, it's in zone D. It's in the most serious criminal offense category. And so what would happen is you got an offense level of 31, which I'll explain in a second how I got to the 31. Then I add 2 levels onto that for the other offenses, as instructed to by the manual. And that gives you a bare minimum of 135 to 168 months. That is 11 to 14 years in prison. That's what the bare minimum number that I can come up with that Paul Manafort is facing as a result of this conviction. And I get there by starting off at a base level of 7 for the bank fraud. You add 18 because it was $4.5 million. You add 2 more because there was hardship to at least one victim. That I should add, there's plenty of range to add even more if you allege
who
that
is the
there
victim
were
there
victims.
Was hardship to.
The victim that there was hardship to would be that you have illicitly convinced a bank to loan you money, and then those funds are not available for the bank to loan out to somebody else, right? Like somebody else had a meritorious loan denied because these banks were...
I wasn't sure if it was the ostrich or something.
Right. Yeah, it could be. It was outside the U.S. That adds another 2. And it was more than $1 million from a financial institution. That adds another 2. There are other grounds for this. And once you start moving up even a single level at this point, the amount of time goes up pretty sharply. Right. So if instead of a 33, it's a 34, right, that adds another 20 months onto the range. If it's a 35, that adds another 17 months onto the range. If it's a 36, all of a sudden now you're looking at 188 to 235 months. That is upwards of 20 years in prison. And so what we're going to see over the next couple of weeks, probably the next month and a half, are the parties will submit sentencing memoranda. And they will argue how to apply these sentencing guidelines. Manafort's lawyers will argue that the court should depart from the guideline range, right? Because the federal sentencing guidelines used to be mandatory. There was a Supreme Court decision in 2005 that shook up the world, particularly of white-collar criminal defense, in which the Supreme Court said that it violates your Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial to not be able to argue for an individualized sentence at trial. And so the Supreme Court struck out the part that made the federal sentencing guidelines mandatory. They are now
advisory. Do we get to read that memoranda? Because yeah. I can't wait. I imagine it's going to be like, look, Paul's just a young kid who got mixed in with the wrong crowd, Your Honor. Give him a chance. Don't let one mistake. You know, yeah, right. I really kind of right. want to read that.
Yeah, no, we will get to see those. And right. and look, things like acceptance of guilt, things like obstruction during the process are reasons for adding or subtracting additional levels. So absolutely, it will, those sentencing memoranda, if they get written, will be very, very interesting and will involve the characterization of Paul Manafort's criminal
patron
activities.
Goal. I'll do a maybe I'll do, you know, like a dramatic reading of the
there
of
we
the
go
sentencing memoranda from the defense side.
That would be awesome. It's good. But yeah. But you noticed I said if they get written and the question.
Oh,
that
if there's
logically
like a
comes to mind
deal or something.
Yeah. Why might so right now? Is there cause to believe that Paul Manafort might come back and enter into some kind of deal with the Mueller team to flip on Donald Trump, right? That's our Yodel Mountain bottom line. And I think there are a couple of reasons to think that maybe he will, right? So look, let's do the pessimism first, right? Which is the moment this verdict came out, Donald Trump took to Twitter and, you know, said, oh, you know, rigged witch hunt and Paul Manafort's a good guy and this is just preposterous. That is such an insane trial balloon that I hope for, you know, my love of country and belief in humanity that that's not going to go anywhere. But these are all federal crimes and Paul Manafort may and can be pardoned for federal crimes. So that could happen.
We need to riot if that happens. I mean, really.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I mean, that is, I will take to the air on OA and say, you know, that would push us into the position of civil disobedience and really, I mean, it would, that should be the Saturday Night Massacre point, right? That I view issuing a pardon to Manafort on the same order as, right, firing Archibald Cox, right, as Nixon instructing ultimately Robert Bork to fire right. Archibald Cox. It is that bad. There is absolutely no reason to do that other than to derail a meritorious investigation of somebody that has the goods on Donald J. Trump. There is no other way. You cannot look at this as a, you know, I mean, we saw the arguments raised in the Manafort trial of like, well, you know, you're ladies and gentlemen of the jury, like the prosecutors never would have even found out about my client's crimes without, you know, I mean,
I wanted to chime in because I did see a tweet about this and I think we've said the same thing, but I just want to emphasize and we won't spend any time on it because there's so much to get to, but just think, I mean, is it your opinion that's probably correct, right? Don't you think that if Donald Trump had never been elected president or had never maybe even run for president, all of these white collar criminals that are now facing, you know, jail time and potential jail time, would they would just be out there white collar criming still? Like, is there any reason to suspect we would have possibly done anything about this? And think about how many more there are probably out there that we don't care about because we're too busy arresting black people for smoking marijuana or something. Like it's mind blowing. Do you think that's correct?
No, I agree with that 100%. But as we saw in the Manafort trial itself, and I think in the court of public opinion, the, you know, my guilty client would have gotten away with it if not
for
Bob Mueller, right? Like,
yeah, I'm not saying that's a good argument. I'm just saying I think they're right. Like they probably would have been just out there white collar criming and nobody would have cared.
Yep. No, I agree. So there you go. Good things about the Trump administration. There we go.
The one thing took us so long to get there, but we found it.
So here are the reasons to think. So that's the reason to think that Manafort might hold out, right? That he might take. And I think Trump used the phrase stay strong, which is all sorts of troubling, as you can imagine. And yeah. I retweeted an article from our buddy Randall Eliason, who we're going to try and get back on the show, saying essentially that, you know, if Donald Trump, that there is a crime if Donald Trump is there is the crime of bribery, right, if Donald Trump gets something in return for issuing his pardon. So even though Trump could pardon Manafort, if the quid pro quo there is Manafort continuing to, quote, stay strong, you know, you can make a criminal case based on that. So we'll have Randall Eisen on and we'll talk about that in more detail. That's the negative side, right? Trump might pardon Manafort. I like to think that won't happen, but I am a notorious optimist.
Yeah.
Reasons to think Manafort might flip. Here, and I'll, we'll go super quickly, but here's what they are, right? Number one, he's got trial in a couple of weeks in Washington, D.C. And in that trial, he faces seven more counts, right? Conspiracy against the United States, conspiracy to launder money, violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, making false statements, obstruction of justice, conspiracy.
All federal charges?
They are all federal charges. Okay. So I look at that, and now Manafort is in criminal history category two. Right. Because he has already been convicted of crimes that amount to more than a year in jail. So he shifts over one column on the table. So my back of the envelope calculation is he's looking at, you know, potentially another 5 years. Yeah. Wow. Well, no, there's no crime charged in the D.C. indictment that carries the same penalty as the bank fraud charges in this case. Right. The bank fraud charges carry a maximum penalty of up to 30 years or a fine of $1 million. That's 18 U.S.C. 1344. There's nothing like that in the D.C. trial, but there are charges that reasonably, if you put it together, probably tack on another 5 years. And we would probably be looking at, combined with whatever happens in this case, of Manafort spending the rest of his life in prison. That's a pretty big bargaining chip. And avoiding that has some incentive. Again, if Mueller's team is inclined to deal, right? We don't know. They may think they have everything they need without Manafort, and it's going to be problematic. I mean, Paul Manafort is going to be a terrible witness if he flips. So, you know, the real question is, what does he have to give the Mueller team that they don't already have? And we don't know the answer to that question. But so number one,
also, what could he have? Well, this is call forward. What could he have that Cohen wouldn't already have? And will there be a little flipping contest?
Yeah.
See who can do more backflips.
Yeah. That's a call forward for about 35 seconds. So,
all right.
But the other thing that is available and is a real thing is Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 35B. Sorry, I abbreviated both as FRCP, which allows the government to apply for reducing a sentence for, quote, substantial assistance. Right. And here's the rule. It says, upon the government's motion made within 1 year of sentencing, the court may reduce a sentence if the defendant, after sentencing, provided substantial assistance in investigating or prosecuting another person. And in evaluating whether the defendant has provided substantial assistance, the court may consider the defendant's pre-sentence assistance and may even reduce the sentence to a level below any statutory minimum sentences, below the minimum guidelines range. So in other words, there's a lot of leverage right now that Mueller's team has over Manafort. He's stayed strong so far. You've got the president of the United States encouraging him to continue to do so. But boy, you could take a lot of that off the table if they think they need him. So,
I know you've been talking about this for a long time, and you've offered the possibility that Mueller or whoever Manafort's such a guilty guy that they may not want to even really offer him a deal. And, I, for one, would be a little disappointed if he got off with a slap on the wrist because he helped You know, because, like, he's really guilty. He's been doing a lot of criminal activity for a long time. And I kind of, I hope Mueller's like, hey, offer your deal. I'll lop off 3 months. Don't help me in all that. Those last 3 months, we'll take those off. Those will be on me.
This is, I am picturing that fantastic scene from The Godfather, right? My offer is this, nothing, not even the cost of the license, which I assume you will pay for yourself, right? Like, that would be that.
You know
that,
what? Maybe look, we haggle, very well we get up to case. 6 or 7 months off, you know, maybe we can haggle. I'm open to haggling.
And look, I think that is a live option and this is a great segue over to Michael Cohen because there is reason to believe that that thought process is in effect in the Michael Cohen plea deal, which is, of course, on the exact opposite side of the spectrum. Hey, guys, today's episode is brought to you by Filter Easy. This I love when we get sponsors like this. You see a theme that all of us are super busy and always forget to do routine household tasks. One of the things I never remember to do on time is change my air conditioning air filters. Here's how Filter Easy works. You sign up, you tell them how many air filters you need and the size, right? You can read that just on the side of it. And they send you the appropriate filters at the appropriate time. The big box arrives on your doorstep and you're like, oh yeah, that's right. I had to go change my filter. Look, if you're like me and you're always late in changing your air filters, you should know particularly in the summer that that's when you risk poor indoor air quality. It exacerbates your allergies. In fact, the EPA ranks poor indoor air quality as one of their top 5 environmental health risks. It's exacerbated if you're like Thomas or I and you have pets and there's pet hair circulating through your AC. You want to be reminded to change your air filters. This is a great service. I use Filter Easy. And one of the cool things is, right, it's a subscription service for something you have to do. You have to change your air filters. It's super practical. It's a no-brainer solution. And here's our call to action. Listeners of the program can receive your first order free by going to filtereasy.com or by dialing 1-855-910-EASY. That's 1-855-910-3279 and use the promo code arguments. So sign up today, filtereasy.com. Get your first order for free. That's filtereasy.com or 1-855-910-EASY. Use the offer code arguments. Give them a try. Hey, you guys know that my law practice is dedicated to helping entrepreneurs, small businesses, the kinds of people who tend to hire people. And that's why I'm always excited when we get ZipRecruiter on as a sponsor. ZipRecruiter built a better online job portal. Instead of just posting a job and hoping the right candidate comes along, the ZipRecruiter platform actually learns what you're looking for, identifies candidates with the right experience, and goes out and invites them to apply for your job. That's why, and I know you know the statistic, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter finds good candidates and sends them to you. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. And as I said in the intro, I'm really excited because OA listeners who are small businesses, businesses of any size, I know you're out there. You guys send me emails. You can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just head on over ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter.com/OA. Post your job. Try it for free. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just
Russia
say yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All right, let's talk about Michael Cohen. Finally, the guy who would take a bullet for Trump, and then someone was like, okay, I have a gun here. He's like, oh, plea deal, plea deal. It's you know, remember when he said he would take a bullet for Troy? I love it. This guy's the best. Yep. All right, Michael Cohen.
Yeah. No, this is right. I mean, this validates every news report that we dismissed as overly speculative early on, right? You know, and pundits were basically saying, look, I mean, this guy's a weasel and, you know, nobody flips like a weasel, right? And and in particular, when he hired Lanny Davis, right, ex-Clinton lawyer, the idea was, okay, well, this means they're going to reach a plea deal. And in fact, that is what's happened.
Yeah. Well, think about the kinds of people, again, who would work for Trump, and also think about the kind of people Trump would think are like good people. Like it's not like he has like great instincts about people. Obviously, all these people around Trump are just in it for themselves, because Trump is just in it for himself. What kind of like altruistic person is like drawn to Donald Trump? You know, like that's not going to happen.
So yeah, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, obviously lifelong. So there's some really interesting things in this plea deal, and they begin right at the very beginning, which is that this deal does not require and is not contingent upon Michael Cohen's cooperation with the prosecutors. Right. Hmm. It is not the same deal that Rick Gates got. Rick Gates got, hey, and we went through it in very specific detail. You're going to get to plead to just one count of making a false statement, and you're going to do that in exchange for total cooperation at our total discretion. And if you violate that, then we can come back and prosecute you for everything. This doesn't have that. And the reason that it does not require Michael Cohen's cooperation is that there's no grant of immunity, right? It is only for the specific crimes that we're going to talk about, to which he has pled guilty. And it contains the language, it being understood that this agreement does not bar the use of this conduct as a predicate act, right? That is the conduct to which Michael Cohen is pleading guilty, or as the basis for a sentencing enhancement in a subsequent prosecution, including but not limited to a prosecution pursuant to 18 U.S.C. 1961. 18 U.S.C. 1961 is the RICO statute. So when you put that in there, that indicates that the prosecutors think there is a possibility that Michael Cohen could be charged in a subsequent RICO action. We're going to talk about the only folks with whom Michael Cohen could be charged in a RICO action in a minute. And then it specifically says this agreement does not provide any protection against prosecution except as explicitly set forth above. So no immunity, no cooperation. Again, parenthetically, Lanny Davis has publicly said Michael Cohen thinks Donald Trump is a criminal and is cooperating with the investigation. You do that because when you go to sentencing, one of the ways to reduce your levels is acceptance of guilt and cooperation with the government. Right. So he's going to try and get levels knocked off of his ultimate sentence, which we're going to.
I am having a hard time keeping up with all of the different charges for all the different. So I can't remind me. This is the result of the taint team and the documents that they raided as off. Is that what all this is? The result?
That's what all this is. Right. And okay. So there are 8 counts to which Michael Cohen has pled guilty. The first 6 of them are tax evasion and false statements to a bank. And they relate to Michael Cohen's status as the taxi king of New York. They have no Yodel Mountain implications whatsoever. Right. They show that he's a scumbag, which, again, you know, we knew, but they have nothing to do with Donald Trump. But counts 7 and 8 are election law violations, campaign violations. They directly implicate Donald Trump. They directly implicate 2 previous stories on opening arguments. I'm going to pat myself and pat us on the back a little bit here. They are exactly what I told you was going to happen way back in OA 154.
It's all the Stormy Daniels chickens coming home to roost.
That's what this is. So I'm going to upload the plea deal. The campaign finance violation allegations begin on page 11, right? And this is Michael Cohen has accepted, this is an information, right? And the difference between an information and an indictment when you're in federal court, an indictment is handed down by the grand jury. You have a Fifth Amendment right to only be charged with a capital or notorious crime, which we have interpreted as being a felony that carries more than a year in prison. You have a right to only be prosecuted for that crime from an indictment from a grand jury. It is common in plea deals to what happens is the defendant will waive that right so that the prosecutor doesn't have to go impanel a grand jury and get an indictment. They can just release an information, which is the same thing. So it's an indictment, but it doesn't come from the grand jury. It's only written by the prosecutors, and it's only valid because the defendant, in this case, Michael Cohen, has waived his right to a grand jury indictment. So he has also allocuted to each and every element of these crimes in open court. Allocute just means to say, to describe. When you plead guilty, you have to describe in your own words what it is that you did. And that's more than a formality, right? Like I actually was advising. I've said I don't do white collar criminal cases. I have advised in some cases back when I was an associate in my big firm days, and we had a white collar case in which the prosecutor was willing to give our client a good deal, but the crime to which they wanted our client to allocute contained an element that my client said, I didn't do that. I cannot stand up in open court and say, you know, I misled people to do X when in fact I did not mislead anybody to do X. So I get that, you know, this is a great deal, but I can't take it the way it's written. And that actually, you know, necessitated a lot of back and forth. So the allocution element is really, really important. Michael Cohen has allocated. We're going to talk about the things that he said during his allocution because they are amazing. But they, as part of that, he has agreed to the allegations that are in the information. And those involve two stories that we covered at great length here on Opening Arguments. And the first is another Andrew was wrong, is OA-158. That was the Karen McDougal story, right? And Karen McDougal is the Playboy playmate who had her story purchased by the National Enquirer. And then she was promised that they were going to run the story, but instead they buried the story, right? And what we said on the show was, hey, if that's all it is, if this is a media organization buying a story and then making an editorial decision to bury it rather than run with it, that's not Yodel Mountain worthy, right? That is not attributable to Donald Trump. There were, you know, kind of these allegations that I don't know. I think I called it far-fetched. This indictment draws together those dots. It is no longer far-fetched. So, yeah, and the alleged relationship was with David J. Pecker, who is the chairman and CEO of the National Enquirer. And here's what the information says about Pecker, whom they describe as Chairman One. They say, in or about August of 2015, Chairman One, in coordination with Michael Cohen, the defendant, and one or more members of the campaign, offered to help deal with negative stories about individual one, that is Donald Trump's, relationships with women by, among other things, assisting the campaign in identifying such stories so that they could be purchased and their publication avoided. Pecker agreed to keep Cohen apprised of any such negative stories. And then it goes through the Karen McDougal allegations and says, despite the cover and article features in the agreement, right? And we talked about that. They paid Karen McDougal $150,000 and promised to run her story, but maintained in the fine print, maintained the right not to run it. And then the allegation says, despite the cover and article features to the agreement, its principal purpose, as understood by those involved, including Michael Cohen, was to suppress Woman One, that is Karen McDougal's story, so as to prevent it from influencing the election. And then we get to the criminal part of the behavior, which is between in or about late August 2016 and September 2016, right? So 2 months before the election, Michael Cohen, the defendant, agreed with Pecker to assign the rights to the non-disclosure portion of the National Enquirer's agreement with McDougal to Cohen for $125,000. Cohen then incorporated a shell entity called Resolution Consultants LLC for use in the transaction. Both Pecker and Cohen signed the agreement, and a consultant for the National Enquirer, using his own shell entity, provided Cohen with an invoice for the payment of $125,000. However, in or about early October 2016, after the agreement was signed, but before Cohen had paid the money, Pecker contacted Cohen and told him in substance that the deal was off and that he should tear up the agreement. And then this is the delightful part and the answer to your question. Cohen did not tear up the agreement, which was later found during a judicially authorized search of his office. So, yeah, you know, he held on to, I guess, as a trophy or something. But think about what this says, right? This says that the only reason to assign that deal to Cohen is so that Cohen is buying it off at the behest of Donald Trump, right? That's the only reason for it to be in Cohen's hands. And ultimately, you know, as we discussed, I guess that Pecker's lawyer is probably smarter than Michael Cohen. And they realized that, you know, they were in much better shape not having the president's personal lawyer involved in paying the hush money. but absolutely, that if what we have here is the CEO of the National Enquirer conspiring with the president's lawyer to bury stories and to apprise Michael Cohen when these stories surfaced, that is at minimum a campaign violation, right? And I would not be surprised. I think the next shoe that's going to drop in this is, I think Pecker is going to be brought up on charges. It is absolutely clear, and Cohen allocuted that it was Pecker who told him about this story and that they worked together to conceal the story in advance of the 2016 election. That's a crime. And so I was wrong in episode 158, right? I said there were, you know, it's possible that the National Enquirer just, you know, decided to buy and bury the story. And so that makes this different from Stormy Daniels. The involvement of Michael Cohen, which was not an allegation in the McDougal lawsuit, will be now. I'm sure she is amending that lawsuit. That changes this from not a crime to a crime. And the crime is corporations cannot start lavishing campaign contributions on individuals. Right. That's totally clear. That is 52 USC 30118. It is an illegal corporate campaign contribution. OK, so I was wrong about McDougal. I was not wrong about Stormy Daniels. And so the allegation says that an agent for Stormy Daniels informed Pecker, editor one. Right. So either Pecker or the editor in chief of the National Review, that she was willing to make public statements and
National Review.
Yeah, I meant National Enquirer, but they're both the same level of journalistic integrity. So Stormy Daniels, we did not know this before. So this is new news, and I have not seen this reported anywhere. Stormy Daniels, through her agent, informed the National Enquirer that she was willing to make public statements and confirm on the record her alleged past affair with Donald Trump. Pecker and the editor then contacted Michael Cohen and put him in touch with the attorney. We've talked about the terrible attorney who signed the deal, who was also representing Stormy Daniels. Over the course of the next few days, Cohen negotiated a $130,000 agreement with that attorney to purchase her silence and received a signed confidential settlement agreement and separate side letter agreement from Attorney One. I will point out again the information Maybe Mueller and his team are OA listeners, but no, really. I would love that, but I think it's just they're smart lawyers. But we made the distinction. We have been making it since OA 154 that this was not a confidentiality agreement. This was a settlement agreement, and this information continues to repeat that. And again, the significance there is you only get to enforce a settlement agreement when you are compromising claims, and so that totally blows the hole in the Trump story of this was fake and I was just worried about her saying fake things. This is yeah. further confirmation of that, right? And then now we get to find out exactly how the money got paid out. This is another bit where we had a lot of speculation. Did the money come out of the Trump campaign? No, it didn't. Here's where it came out, but it's worse because of course it is, right? So this is paragraph 34 on October 26, 2016. Again, think about that. That's a week yeah. before the election, right? On October 26, 2016, the defendant emailed an incorporating service to obtain the corporate formation documents for another shell corporation, Essential Consultants LLC, which he had incorporated a few days prior. Later that afternoon, Michael Cohen drew down $131,000 from the fraudulently obtained home equity line of credit, which was also the subject of prior counts, and requested that it be deposited into a bank account that he had just opened in the name of Essential Consultants. The next morning, he went to the bank and wired $130,000 from Essential Consultants to Stormy Daniels' attorney. On the bank form to complete the wire, Cohen falsely indicated that the purpose of wire being sent was, quote, retainer. On or about November 1, Cohen received from Stormy Daniels' attorney copies of the final signed confidential settlement agreement and side letter agreement. So, again, November.
Yeah.
So, as it turns out, Michael Cohen did, in fact, make the payment to Stormy Daniels himself from his own bank account financed by a home equity line of credit. You might be thinking, that seems kind of odd for an attorney to just pay $130,000 on behalf of a client who's a billionaire, and you would be right.
Right.
This may be my favorite paragraph in the entire. Look, the information is amazing, and everyone should read it. I'm stunned by this. This is fantastic. Paragraph 37. So January of 2017, right? So keep this in mind, right? Michael Cohen pays out $130,000. In January, he sends Donald Trump a bill. And here's the bill he sends. $130,000 payment, plus a $35 wire fee, plus adding in handwriting an additional, quote, $50,000 as payment for tech services, which are alleged to be, quote, in fact related to work Cohen had solicited from a technology company during and in connection with the campaign. So that adds up to $180,035. Then he submits this to the Trump Organization, which is referred to as Company One in the information, which then, quote, grossed up for tax purposes by doubling that amount, and then adds a bonus of $60,000 to Cohen. So Cohen would be paid $420,000 in total off of this $180,000 invoice. You're an ex-accountant, or you have an accounting background. In what way do you gross up a $180,000 bill so that it's $360,000? I mean, is that something I don't know?
When you're just, and this is just, you're paying a vendor, right? Like ostensibly, oh, it's got some tech services. Well, for tax purposes, let's double the bill we're paying a vendor, naturally, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that doesn't happen at all.
Okay, good. I mean, I thought so. It seemed weird. So then the Trump Organization specified, it says executives of the company determined that the $420,000 would be paid to Cohen in monthly installments, 12 months, $35,000. And again, I'm telling you, every word in this paragraph is priceless. And that Cohen should send invoices for these payments, right? And as I'm reading this, I'm just thinking about how, like, in you know, in The Godfather, it's Fredo, right? Like in Casino, it's that low-level guy who keeps his like list of expenses, and that's what the feds are able to find. Like, it's always the dumbest guy in the room who's, you know, keeping exact
records of their
criminal transaction.
But in this situation, everybody is the dumbest guy in the room. Every single person in this room is the dumbest person.
Yeah, there are, it's Fredo all the way down. Right?
It's like, all Fredos. Yeah, that's you know what, I don't. That's really not giving enough credit to Fredo. But okay.
Yeah. Right.
I was just thinking. Then, I can't wait for Brian's invoice for like August. Yeah. He's like, hey, for taxes, you got to double this plus add $50,000 for taxes, because that's how you pay vendors taxes.
So. February 14th, 2017, Donald Trump is president of the United States, and Michael Cohen sends the first of his monthly invoices requesting, quote, pursuant to a retainer agreement, payment for services rendered for the months January and February of 2017, and requesting the $35,000. And then it was approved by someone referred to as Executive One, presumably distinct from Individual One, so not personally approved by Donald Trump. There's no evidence of that at this point, but there is evidence that a high-ranking executive at the Trump Organization approved and forwarded that email to another employee at the company stating, please pay from the trust, post to legal expenses, put retainer for the months of January and February 2017 in the description. Let's break that down, right? Pay from the trust means the Donald J. Trump Charitable Foundation, right? Pay this out of our charity, post it to legal expenses, and falsely call it a retainer. I do not need to tell you that these are separate crimes. The information says the company accounted for these in truth, and in fact, there was no such retainer agreement, and the monthly invoices Cohen submitted were not in connection with any legal services that he had provided. This is the kind of white-collar criminal activity that Bob Mueller could prosecute in his sleep. These are very, very easy, straightforward cases to make. And yes, there is an intentionality requirement, but remember, right, in all of these cases, right, the defense that the executive gives, well, you know, I didn't approve. I didn't know this person was just, you know, kind of off, right, half cocked, right, right, and whatever. Right. That's the officer. I just had two beers during dinner. You know, when you're pulled over of excuses. Right. Like that. Everybody makes that excuse and nobody buys it. And
only that, it seems like recordings could pretty easily dispel that notion.
We know Michael Cohen is a pack rat. We know that he's kept everything. He's kept audio recordings. He kept a document that he was required by the rules of professional ethics to destroy. And we know that he tried to shred documents and the Mueller team had no problems putting those back together again. This is that's what's coming next, is that, we are going to see, I believe, a grand jury impaneled to hand down an indictment on Pecker. And I believe we are going to see the scope of the Mueller investigation expand to include whoever the unnamed executive at a minimum of the Trump Organization is. This is the information they have that Michael Cohen has confirmed and corroborated. And there's one more huge Yodel Mountain impact to this. And that goes all the way back to episode 168, the first time that Michael Cohen pled the fifth. And you may recall that there is a lawsuit pending in the state of California that was stayed pending the result of potential criminal investigation in the state of New York, right? We covered it. We talked about how the California court said, yeah, you know what? Like, we're not going to get out in front of the New York court if Michael Cohen is potentially indicted. So we're going to stay proceedings in the civil case. Now that that's gone, that case, that stay will be lifted. Michael Avenatti is going to petition the court to lift the stay. It will go forward, and that court will issue discovery. And the primary discovery
being
sought.
Remind us what this case, what was the California case for?
The California case is about the validity of the settlement
agreement.
Yeah.
Okay.
And crucial discovery to that case is deposing Donald J. Trump.
Well, but
that's what they've requested.
Couldn't Donald J. Trump, couldn't they just drop it? Like, just be like, never mind, and not do discovery?
Yes, they could. They can compromise the suit, right? So they could do this in a couple of ways, right? So number one, they could settle the lawsuit. I don't believe Stormy Daniels is interested in a settlement with Donald Trump.
Right.
I don't believe that that's on the table. What you can do, knowing that the other party will not agree, right, you can stipulate in open court. You can say, look, they don't have to prove this. They don't need discovery because we're going to stipulate in open court that this agreement is unenforceable, right? So that would be the counter move, is Trump's lawyers would say, okay, you're interested in the settlement. Avenatti laughs until his lungs explode and then has to get an associate on the line to say, no, we're not interested in a settlement. And then they say, okay, well, then we're going to go to the court and we're just going to say, we stipulate that this agreement is unenforceable, so you don't get any discovery. That's what Stormy Daniels wants. If the agreement is unenforceable, then she can go forward and absolutely.
That's what I thought you were going to say, but I mean, she already did a 60 Minutes interview. Like, is it just the difference of she'll release pictures or something?
She will release not only pictures, but she will release. Remember that the terms of the agreement include text messages sent by Donald Trump. We don't know what those are. So look, is it possible, right? Is it possible through all of this that the text messages are just garden variety, disgusting sex tweets between
locker room texts. I'm pretty sure that's all it's going to be.
If that's all that it is, right, then I agree with you that, you know, that doesn't change the situation because, right. You know, this is if you were not already appalled at Donald Trump from the Access Hollywood tape, then not going to move the needle, right? Like, that's baked in. Now, the cognitive dissonance of, you know, the evangelical Christian. So, you know, that we would have to do an entire separate podcast on that. And in fact, you have done an entire separate podcast on that. But if any one of those text messages is, hey, look, like, we got to keep this quiet because, you know, I got the whole president thing going on. That to me is a game changer, right? That to me is the president of the United States admitting to conspiring to break the election laws. That's the equivalent of posing with the dollar sign, you know, the sack of money with a dollar sign on the outside of it. And I think that's a big deal. It's possible, right? I heard your last, you know, SIO on predictions. You actually made a really, really good post on Facebook yesterday
I did a post on Facebook, and here's the thing. We're way too long in a show that we're trying to get out early, and Brian has to still edit, and we still need to thank patrons and do TTBE. So here's what we're thinking. There's just too much. There's too much more we need to talk about. We got to talk about Dershowitz. We got to talk about how serious are these election law violations really in the scheme of things. There's like seven more bullet points of Andrew's. We are going to do a bonus patron only episode because there's too much. And this is such a gigantic turn of events these last few days that I feel like our patrons who have been with us and been supporting the show and making it happen, I think you've earned it. We're going to do a patron only episode with the remainder of this. But I think, Andrew, you've already done, you put in a solid, you know, 70 minutes for everybody of breaking down a lot of the major points of this gigantic news. And I know it won't be the end. So that's what we're thinking we're going to do. So go to patreon.com/law if you'd like to hear that. Still lots more to talk about, but we honestly can't turn around an episode fast enough. If we keep going for another 60 minutes, it's just not going to work, and Brian will quit and I'll be left editing myself. So that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's great. We have so much. I'm really, really excited to continue this conversation. But hopefully for the regular listeners of the show, you're excited about getting the episode early and getting a breakdown and the Yodel Mountain implications of what's coming next in light of the Manafort conviction and the Cohen plea deal.
All right, top patrons, and we begin with Poseidon is 9/10 of maritime law. I love that one. K. Often, K. Well, do you pronounce the T in often? I shouldn't. K. Often Vlogger. Ryan Byrne, Healing Elementals on Etsy, promo code OpenArgs for 10% off. Sam, Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU3L. Asbestos a day keeps the doctor away. Let this radicalize you rather than lead you to despair. Always a good message. Mike the Intactivist, join your labor union. Notice gratis, POTUS, CHOSUS, BOGUS, SCOTUS, ZEALOTS. A Chicago Cubs fan wished on a monkey's paw in 2016. Getting off podcast. That's a good one. Getting off podcast. Jean-Luc Picard flagrantly violated the prima facie directive when he, and it cuts off, but okay. Tampa Bay Devil Rays. That's it. That's the joke this week. Ooh, take that, Andrew. David Satz. Took legal advice from a podcast and all I got was this orange jumpsuit. Rob Schreck, Brian Upshaw's last chance for profit prison. But lady, I'm flying a spaceship. Buttercup's polyphony services, actual yodeling advice from an actual cat. E.E. Cummings in front of a gold fringed flag. I just pretend Andrew is whispering sweet nothings into my ears. Could God make a cake so gay that it would make even him bicurious? I really like that one. Oh, that's good. Anonymous. Dalen Lee Samus Grix. I hope I pronounced that right. Another Two Live Crew reference. Mr. Poopy Butthole. Stormy Daniels is a legal genius. Is the best. Andrew was right. Oh, man. You really were. I think Oof. You nailed pretty much every single component of that. And that was, what, a million years ago? It's been a while. Two top patrons just got engaged. Oh, congratulations. Ah, that's so great. If I shave my eyebrows, will it make my alternate timeline goatee? Needs a new Patreon name in a hurry. Bring back Bulky. Keith Davies. Dave, stop using my Patreon to make Andrew say things. This week in news with Kevin and Benedict. Put your analyst on danger money, baby.
That's another Hitchhiker's Guide quote.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I don't get it. WordOrigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Everything that guy said was bullshit. Thank you, the Manafort defense team. Whitey Karowski, Max Lanier, Eddie Waitkiss, and Johnny Vandermeer. I don't know if that's what that is. If it's people teaming up to patronize us, that is A-OK with us. All right.
I doubt that it is deceased San Francisco Giant Johnny Vandermeer.
Ah,
but
okay.
Anyway, keep
see,
going.
I don't. I'm not a baseball person. I wasn't sure what the reference
double no
was,
hit. But. Good old double no hit.
Wow. Cool.
All right. And thank you to Saul, 3D Print Super Soakers Instead. There is always room for more experts. Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters, Legalize the Purge, a real Star Wars fan, Feed Brian to the Shark Decons. That's awesome. Nothing worse than a monster who thinks he's right with God. Am I being impeached, officer? I, Thomas Smith, think Infinity War is the greatest movie ever. Oh my God. That your live blogging of Infinity War is in fact the greatest thing.
Yeah, go to the Philosophers in Space Facebook group to check that out. I did live blog the second half of Infinity War.
Oh, it was amazing. Rhonda the Baked Alaskan, Malika Chandler, Hot Spots on My Dog, Soggy Pants, CampQuest.org, 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 Dave, Living Life, Yodel Mountain High in Trump's America, Sam Danow, Greg Sullivan, The True Use of the Three Shells, Adopt a Homeless Pet and a Post Decline. And ear docking. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Aaron Grady, Matthew Vernon. Another Cohen Bites the Dust. That's awesome. The Wayward Willis Podcast. Ian and Allie. I misspoke. I meant to say best, not first patron. Sakashite Fukusumi will impeach all Trumpses and cancel Brexitses. All right, good. Jim Grove, Eli Bosnick, our buddy Eli, cooking Heath with ramen. Mitchell, successfully proposed to another top patron. I don't know if I can say who. Well, that
ooh,
other person.
I think
also
I, said, yeah, I have yeah. some idea of who it might be based yeah? on my.
Carl Carlson and Lenny Leonard. I hereby promise to make a yodel video wearing only lederhosen. Well, give wow. Lydia a segment like Lucinda has on Scathing. A grizzled veteran of the war on info. And as always, our top patron, we love you, Conrad Michaels.
Oh, so great. Such a great segment. I hope you guys enjoy the bonus episode. I can't wait to do that. We have so much to talk about. But thank you for supporting the show, getting all the goodies. We're already coming up on another round of Lot Awful Movies and the Q&A toward the end of the month here. So patreon.com/law if you'd like to join their ranks.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. It's TTTBE time.
All right, TTTB 90, and you are already over 50, so we are headed up to hopefully towards a 60% in the first half. This is a torts question. A construction company was digging a trench for a new sewer line in a street in a high-crime neighborhood. During the course of the construction, there had been many thefts of tools and equipment from the construction area. One night, the construction company's employees neglected to place warning lights around the trench. A delivery truck drove into the trench and broke an axle. While the truck driver was looking for a telephone to call the tow truck, thieves broke into the truck and stole $350,000 worth of goods. The delivery company sued the construction company to recover the $350,000 loss and for the damage to its truck. The construction company has stipulated that it was negligent in failing to place warning lights around the trench and admits to liability for damage to the truck, but denies liability for the loss of the goods. On cross motions for summary judgment on the claim for the goods, how should the court rule?
Cross motions.
A, deny both motions because there is evidence to support a finding that the construction company should have realized that its negligent could create an opportunity for a third party to commit a crime. B, grant the construction company's motion because no one could have foreseen that the failure to place warning lights could result in the loss of a cargo of valuable goods. C, grant the construction company's motion because the criminal acts of third persons were a superseding cause of the loss. Oof. Or D, grant the delivery company's motion because but for the construction company's actions, the goods would not have been stolen.
Oh, man, this is really hard. All this on the biggest news day in forever, and my brain is frazzled, and this is like the hardest part. This has got to be one of the hardest ones, because I feel like virtually every answer, I think pretty much every answer, this has happened a few times, I think every answer makes sense to me. Like, I could easily make an argument for every answer, because as I was going through the question, so it's, you know, straightforward, they didn't put the signs or the lights, and so therefore a truck goes into the thing, is damaged, and then thieves steal stuff. Now, I could easily see that, but for, I was going to even say that before I saw D, but for the trench that damaged the truck, the thieves never would have been able to break into. And I think it's reasonable to say that if you cause a delivery truck to break down, that would have just been driving through, and it's not as though, you know, Mad Max bandits are going to like drive up next to a truck and steal stuff. And that's never going to happen, except for the fact that what you did led to a truck being broke down. But also, I could really see, so that's D essentially, but I could also see C, because the criminal acts of third persons caused the loss. Like, that there's a certain amount, you know, like, is it reasonable? Is it ever going to be that you should expect that people are going to commit crimes and you're liable for what they did? And I don't know. So C actually seems really strong. A, I'll go reverse order. B, grant the construction company's motion because no one could have foreseen that the failure to place warning lights could result in the loss of a cargo of valuable goods. Man, I mean, that seems reasonable, but I would say maybe B is the one. It could be right, but I think I'm going to eliminate B, because I think you could have very easily foreseen that the failure to place warning lights would result in the loss of cargo. Now, maybe it's not thieves, but it could have been the truck crashes into the trench and everything is ruined. You know, I think that's very easy to foresee. So I'm going to eliminate B. And then A, deny both motions because there's evidence to support a finding that the construction company should have realized that its negligence could create an opportunity for a third party to commit a crime. See, that is super strong. Oh, there's one that I think I can eliminate in B, but A, C, and D are solid answers. Very solid answers in my mind. Maybe I'm missing something. They all seem very reasonable. So I'm going to have to just decide what I think is the reasonable thing. All right. So now we've added another thing into the mix, which I'm realizing the language of the question. So there's cross motion. So I guess that means both parties are saying, hey, judge, give me a summary judgment on the claim. A says deny both motions because there's evidence to support a finding that the construction company should have realized that. I don't understand why you would deny both motions, because it's like deny both motions, but then it sounds like you'd be granting the delivery company's motion. So I'm very confused, which sucks because I want to go with A, but that doesn't make sense to me. Or does it just mean you're not granting a motion for summary judgment? You're going to do some other thing. Because D, the other one, so B and C are grant the construction company's motion and D is grant the delivery company's motion. This sucks. This is impossible. I'm not a lawyer. I wanted to go with A, but now I'm wondering if it's D because that's granting the... A has the best language after the deny both motions part. Because they should have realized. What I was going to say is it has been a high crime area. There have been many thefts of tools. That's part of the question. And so they should have realized that negligence could create an opportunity for a third party to commit a crime. All right. I have no confidence. I'm going to go with A. I don't know why it says deny both motions. I think that hopefully that just means that it's going to go along with some other motion. I don't know. This sucks. This is really hard. I'm going to go with A. My second guess is D. But B and C are also good. So that's my final answer.
And if you agree with Thomas that the answer is either A, B, C, or D, you can play along. You know how to do that. Just share out the episode on social media. Include the hashtag TTTB. Include your answer, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
You had to throw that question on me and then an episode that's already long and we're trying to get out. That was hard. That was really, really hard. But that just goes to show that Andrew doesn't manipulate, you know, the question. He doesn't. This is all, you know, this is the sanctity of the game. Sanctity of the game. All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. Wow. What a week. This is crazy. We've got so much more to talk about on that bonus episode. We're going to record that right now. And we will get that to you as soon as we can, patrons. And in the meantime, for everybody else, we'll have to see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
I was just thinking, I can't wait for Brian's invoice for like August. Yeah. He's like, hey, for taxes... Yeah, you got to double this plus add $50,000 for taxes, because that's how you pay vendors taxes.